Well, happy Thursday to you, or Donnerstag, as they say in German. I'm Eric Detheridge for Craig Blumenschein, who will be back in the hosting chair on Tuesday with you. So I'm teaching my 9-year-old a little German, because her grandmother is German, so she could better converse with her, on the way to school pretty much every day. And yes, that's the sign that summer vacation is pretty much over, driving the kids to school, right? But you wouldn't know it in Colfax, North Dakota, where they're gearing up for the first ever Red River Roots Bluegrass and Folk Festival, keeping the vibes of summer alive. Later in the show, we'll talk to organizers and get a performance from the headlining band Kohlrabi Soup. Well, speaking of back to school, there's a promising effort to address special education teacher shortages. Craig Blumenschein has this conversation.
Main Street begins today with looking at a new $5.2 million Bush Foundation grant awarded to Minot State University special education programs. The funding will expand Project Pipeline, an effort to recruit, train, and retain special education teachers across North Dakota, especially in rural communities. The initiative creates a clear career path starting with high school students and extending all the way to graduate level leadership. It's at a time when schools across the state face persistent shortages. This project could be transformational for students with disabilities and for the educators who serve them. I have two guests today. Let me introduce first Holly Peterson. She's professor of special education at Minot State University and co-director of Project Pipeline. She has more than 20 years experience in preparing special education teachers and developing innovative models like the para-to-teacher pathway. Holly, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Catherine Terrace is the CEO of Certification Central and co-director of Project Pipeline. She pioneered the education technician model in North Dakota and has led efforts to create accessible and flexible licensure pathways for educators. Catherine, also welcome to Main Street.
Nice to be here.
Holly, I'd like to start with you if I could. Why has recruiting and retaining special education teachers been such a persistent challenge in North Dakota, and especially in rural areas?
Well, I think that there's a variety of factors. That's what the research tells us, is that there's a lot of factors. I think that across the board in education, we have fewer folks leaving high school and going into that as a profession. And schools have faced a lot of challenges. I think there are multifaceted reasons for that. Some things like behavior and mental health issues have come up. Pay is one thing, although that's not at the top of the list in North Dakota or in many other states. In North Dakota, we're impacted by that nationwide trend as well. It's harder to get folks into the special education profession, and sometimes it's harder to keep them there.
Catherine, your work has highlighted the need for more flexible career pathways. How does Project Pipeline address that need differently than past approaches?
Well, several years ago, North Dakota was very innovative and looked at how can we take a working professional working as a paraprofessional and move them into a licensed teacher, growing your own model. So the district special education units could invest in them. But there are individuals who are current paraprofessionals who aren't ready to go on and complete a 4-year degree. Some of them are very intimidated. So what would be a mid-level position to meet the state of North Dakota's need, as well as get a paraprofessional on a trajectory of moving toward becoming a licensed teacher? So there was a task force that came together for 1 year that was representative of state organizations, legislators, individuals, leaders from the field, CTE, and came up with the concept of the mid-level position of a special education technician. And that really allowed that flexibility that you inquired about, because it wasn't, you can either be a paraprofessional or you could be a licensed teacher. There was a new pathway or position in North Dakota called the special education technician. North Dakota has been working really hard to recruit and retain teachers and move them into a pipeline.
For those listeners who are unfamiliar with it, what exactly is Project Pipeline, and how does it work from high school through graduate training?
So we had the opportunity to work with the Bush Foundation previously on a 2-year grant, focusing on that middle part of the pipeline that Catherine just alluded to, really looking at SPED technician to a licensed teacher. So when folks were ready to move on to that 4-year degree, there was a pathway for them to do that. with this grant, we had an opportunity to work with the Bush Foundation again. And this time we have 5 years and some more funding support to really expand that whole pipeline. So conceptualizing all the way along from building interest in career exploration amongst high school students through dual credit opportunities onto those entry level positions of paraprofessionals to sped tech or a mid-level position onto that initial teacher licensure, but then also beyond that into leadership opportunities at the master level, so that the goal is that we would have that steady stream of people within the pipeline at all levels to make it be robust and to try to establish a sustainable source of people to support students with disabilities.
When I contemplated visiting with you ladies, I thought about, okay, recruiting teachers. And to me, generally, that's meant math teachers, science teachers, coaches, if you will, et cetera. I had never thought about it in the context of recruiting teachers to teach special ed. Do you find students are surprised of the opportunities and what it means to be a special ed teacher? Do they come to Minot University unsure about what that means and then learn about it and think this is for me? How does that process work in special ed?
Well, you know, people find their way to that profession in a variety of pathways. Some have had personal experiences or what have you. But with a para-to-teacher or a grow-your-own model, when students have had experience working as a paraprofessional alongside a licensed special education teacher, and then they've taken perhaps some work as a special education technician and expanded their skills, they already know what they're signing up for. Every once in a while, especially if we have a traditional student who maybe is 18, graduates from high school and says, yeah, I'm going to be a special ed teacher. Sometimes once they get into it, as in other professions, they realize, yeah, this isn't what I thought it was going to be, or this isn't for me. We don't have that, of course, with the paraprofessionals because they're in it every day and they're working with those students. They're working alongside that licensed teacher. So they have a very good idea about what the profession entails when they come and seek that four-year degree.
Take us inside the classroom. What difference will this make for students with disabilities, do you anticipate here in North Dakota? Holly, you can maybe start first and then Catherine, go on.
Yeah, I think that's one of our favorite things to talk about, Craig, because ultimately that is who our clients or the end recipients of this whole grant will be, is students with disabilities and their families. I think that all of us could agree that the most deciding factor in a child's education is that great teacher that they have, someone who has the knowledge, the skills, the know-how to support that student's success, whatever that might look like. And so we know there's a shortage, but we don't want to sacrifice that quality because, of course, any time that you send somebody out to a difficult profession, and they are not equipped, they're not fully equipped with the knowledge and skills of what to do in difficult situations, they're not going to stay. And that just contributes to that retention problem. So we want folks that are fully prepared and like those challenging situations, because special education is one of those professions that people may say it's the hardest job you'll ever love. And it is. It's not easy, but I've been in the field now a little over 3 decades as a special education teacher, and not every day was sunshine and roses for sure, but I've never wished to do anything different. And it is because of those students and seeing them reach their potential, seeing them work hard and struggle and be able to reach their goals is really the reinforcement, I think, in that dynamic. Catherine, what do you say?
Yes, I would agree with that. And although I am the CEO of Certification Central, I spend the majority of my time out in the field with kids and teachers. So I get a firsthand view of how impactful this is. Because Project Pipeline is across training up paraprofessionals all the way to teacher leaders, we see the impact that they have on our students with disabilities, because the more qualified every individual is, with the more skills that they're acquiring, the more they're going to help students meet their needs. And our first project with Project Pipeline is called Project Para. And that is personalized accessible resources for advancement. So we will be releasing that this week, but the focus is training paraprofessionals to really have advancement in their knowledge and skills. There were special education units that came to us and said, we really want to invest in our paraprofessionals to give them more knowledge and skills. And then how can we make that investment? And then how can we get them on that trajectory then to become that special ed technician to the teacher? So the training that they will be able to take as paraprofessionals will be personalized. It's very specific to their job. And then they will be able to earn credit for that training to go toward that special education technician or the licensed teacher.
That was Catherine Terrace. She's the CEO of Certification Central and co-director of Project Pipeline. My other guest is Holly Peterson, professor of special education at Minot State University and co-director of Project Pipeline. Both are talking about a new $5.25 million Bush Foundation grant awarded to Minot State University's special education programs. How will rural school districts benefit from this? It seems to me they're often hit hardest by teacher shortages here in North Dakota. How will they benefit from this program?
Well, the Grow Your Own model really does invest in folks who are there. They're in those communities, and they're often in those communities because they want to be. They're staying there. Maybe their family is there. Maybe they are, you know, married to a spouse who has land there. You know, agriculture in our rural areas is an important part in our state. But for whatever the reason, if that person is there and their school invests in them and they want to invest in their community, the Grow Your Own model really can have a high impact for those rural schools because you're training somebody who wants to be there and seeks to be there and has career advancement for not only the students that they're working with, but also for their own personal lives and families.
How do either of you integrate with school districts, teachers, community stakeholders, parents of folks who have disabilities? What's that communication like as you try to get better at what you do?
Well, I can speak to that one. I spend the majority of my time in the field with students, teachers, and a lot of meetings with parents. So it's very valuable for me to see the needs firsthand, the needs of the profession, the needs of students. So we can speak directly and very specifically to those needs. Holly and I have collaborated together for a long time, even before I opened up Certification Central. And so we collaborate to develop different statewide task force when we identify that there may need to be let's say a legislative lift or a problem out in practice that needs to be discussed. So bringing together individuals from the field and parents, state representatives to have those conversations so you can really get a 360 look at the various facets of let's say a problem that needs to be changed or solved is incredibly helpful. We're also very focused on our advisory council that we put together during our first Project Pipeline that was, again, representative of all the stakeholders representing special education. So we are receiving guidance very formally along the way through that advisory council, as well as just informally every day in the field that keeps us up to date of what's happening.
What are the biggest misconceptions the public has about special education?
That is an interesting question for sure. You know, I think you can't necessarily know unless you've been there. And so that is sometimes difficult, especially, you know, we have such a diverse population. If folks don't have school age kids, if they haven't worked in schools, I think everybody may have misconceptions about education in general, not just special education. But I think, you know, our profession really has started on the basics of every child can learn. Every child is unique, and we can, that's really where the art and science of teaching comes together is you work to identify what those unique individual needs are, and then you match your teaching strategies to that specific need to close that gap. And so I think that's what it's all about, no matter what type of child you're talking about.
Catherine, do you have thoughts about the question?
You know, I do. When we think about special education teachers, licensed professionals, and we think about student needs and student gaps, the education domain of closing those gaps is one component. The services that are also available statewide, community-based services, all of those have to work together and in unison to truly wrap around that student to bring about the most robust change for maintaining maintenance and maintenance relative to having that student progress and not, what's the word I'm looking for, digress. But it really, that concept of it takes a village is absolutely, absolutely at the core of that all resources need to work together. And the special education personnel are very, very happy and pleased to be able to work alongside state and community teams as well.
As we wrap up our conversation, it seems to me there's a movement towards private education for some folks. And oftentimes I hear, well, that's all well and good, except for folks who need special education services. And it's not fair to them that those opportunities aren't equal. Is that your perception?
Yeah, I think that's the question that the whole nation is wondering about. And it's true, we just don't know right now. I think that there are different ways to fund things. But, you know, looking historically what we've done in the United States, as well as how other countries are doing this, I think there are ways to still achieve that same goal. And the funding models or the delivery of that could look different, depending on what gets decided at the federal level. But one thing I know for sure is that a group of dedicated people can still accomplish those amazing things. And we certainly have in North Dakota, and that's one of the things that I think is particularly wonderful about our state of North Dakota, is that we work together, as Catherine just mentioned, working alongside those other types of services that impact students with disabilities. It's great with those relationships that we have in the state to be able to work collaboratively. Sometimes when I go to other national conferences, another colleague from another state may say, wow, how do you get the people from this particular entity to call you back? We can't even get them to come to a meeting with us. And that's really not been the case in North Dakota in really my whole career. Are there barriers and challenges that we need to work through? You bet there are. But there are people who want to come to the table and try to figure it out together.
Catherine, I'll give you the last word here.
Yes, well, when it comes to looking at the needs of students with disability, in some cases, it's all hands on deck. We need to look at what public education has to offer, which is in abundance. And at times we need to look and see what's out there privately too, that may be a really good fit for a student who has pretty significant needs. And I guess when we look at how the private and the public can collaborate, Project Pipeline is an example of that. Minot State University, where Holly is located, is a public institution, and Certification Central is private. So how do you take the best of the two to produce something that can be quite impactful statewide?
My guests have been Holly Peterson, a professor of special education at Minot State University, co-director of Project Pipeline, and Catherine Terrace, CEO of Certification Central and also co-director of Project Pipeline. We've been chatting about a new $5.25 million Bush Foundation grant awarded to Minot State University's special education programs. As the school year begins, ladies, best wishes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today on Main Street.
Speaking as a parent with experience in this area, it really does take an all-hands-on-deck approach to raise students with disabilities. And I could tell you, folks like you just heard who are so dedicated to the profession are vital in helping parents raise happy, healthy kids who have differing abilities. Great conversation with Craig and his guests. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship, September 2nd through October 7th until noon central. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their self-designed leadership plan. More information at bushfoundation.org. And by LiveWire, a provider of live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and streaming services for events, conferences, and meetings across the Prairie region and around the country. More information at livewirenow.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 28th. In 1912, political fervor and interest swept the country over the presidential election. President Taft sought the Republican nomination, challenged by former President Theodore Roosevelt, who unexpectedly entered the race. Senator Robert La Follette was yet another contender for the nomination. When North Dakota held its primary that March, La Follette was the winner even over Roosevelt, who was so popular in the state. Various newspapers claimed that Democrats had voted for La Follette, affecting the results. And those with La Follette claimed that reactionaries and stand-patters alone voted for Roosevelt. Nonetheless, La Follette's popularity fell off, and as the Republican Party looked to back Taft, Roosevelt still sought the presidency under a third party, the National Progressive Party. It was becoming well known as the Bull Moose Party after he described himself as fit as a bull moose. There were men in North Dakota who supported Roosevelt. Dorr H. Carroll, who owned a farm near Carpio, was also an attorney, ex-newspaper man, real estate dealer, and merchant, and was very involved in progressive politics. He had backed La Follette, but now threw himself behind Roosevelt. By early August, a brief note in the Bismarck Tribune stated he was in full charge of the state's progressive campaign. What there is of it. There were men in North Dakota who supported Roosevelt. With all the back and forth, it may have seemed especially ominous when, on this date, some valuable documents of the Bull Moose Party were stolen from Dorr Carroll as he traveled on a Great Northern passenger train. A search ensued for a thief, but the manhunt ending was rather tame. It was just a case of mistaken baggage. Another man had taken Mr. Carroll's suitcase instead of his own. Noticing the mistake, the man immediately notified Carroll and the bag. Its valuable contents were returned. By the way, the 1912 election ended with North Dakota voting for Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I am Ann Olquist.
All right, welcome back to Main Street here on listener-supported Prairie Public if you're just joining us. Happy Thursday to you. We've got a real fun show for you in store with some live music up next. And then later in the show, Dave Thompson joins me to break down this week's news. We'll have a candid discussion about what happened in Minneapolis yesterday. And Dave is going to give you a little Cold War North Dakota-style history. So stay tuned for that here on Prairie Public. Oh, if you think the summer is over for music festivals, well, not to quote Judas Priest or anything, but you've got another thing coming. And no, it's not heavy metal, but a heavy dose of roots music that's happening in Colfax, North Dakota on Saturday, September the 13th. It's the first annual Red River Roots Bluegrass Festival. And today on Main Street, you're in for a real musical treat. We've got some folks to talk about the festival, some organizers, and some musicians to play some music for you. We've got Aaron Niehaus, Joey Pettit, and Steve Burkett, part of the band Kohlrabi Soup, along with organizers Mary Niehaus and Adam Davis, who will give some details on the big show. Welcome to you all.
Hello. Yeah, thank you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hey, let's not keep folks waiting. Let's kick it in gear right now, high gear, with the song. What's your first one?
Well, this first tune is an instrumental called Red Haired Boy. Thank you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. You just heard a live tune from members of Kohlrabi Soup, who are headlining the first annual Red River Roots Bluegrass Festival happening in beautiful Colfax, North Dakota on September the 13th. This is a statewide show, guys. For those that don't know where Colfax is, where is that on the map?
So Colfax is about 30-minute drive south of Fargo, just west of Wahpeton. It's right along the riverside. It used to be a wedding venue, and the hosts have since kind of retired from the wedding business, and now they are contributing to the community with other events like Unglued Craft Fest also has an event that they put on out at Crooked Lane every year, and we're happy to be part of their event roster.
You know, obviously it's hard enough to organize any festival, but especially an inaugural festival. But you guys had some help, some partners. Can you kind of describe who's on board with you?
Well, thanks to efforts from my mother, Mary Niehaus, is also on the interview with us today. We were awarded a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which is very helpful. Just the maximum amount that the Arts Council gives out for grants, and so we can tell that they're very supportive of this initiative to put this together. Other sponsors include the North Dakota Bluegrass Association. They've been very helpful, and other financial sponsorships include Flatland Guitar. Flatland Guitar is a generous sponsor of this festival as well.
So tell me about the day itself, September the 13th. It's at Crooked Lane Farm in Colfax. So who all, aside from Kohlrabi Soup, who's headlining, who all is playing? What kind of vibe are you going for? What kind of activities are there for the kids?
So we wanted this event to be kind of a mashup between bluegrass festivals that members of our group have gone to and have been inspired from, and something that will appeal to more of a broad group of people in the Fargo-Moorhead community. So we wanted to add some bluegrass music into the mix, and then also have kind of a backline of local groups and folk music, just to give something to everybody. So we have Kohlrabi Soup, that's our group, we're a bluegrass band. A JT Canelli Band is another group I'm excited to hear play. They draw inspiration from bluegrass music, classic country, lots of those traditional bluegrass songs that we like. Up-and-coming group in Fargo that's also on the bill for the festival is a group called the TBD Trio, and that stands for Tony, Bailey, and David.
Okay, it's not a mystery band. It actually is.
It's a band. It's a real band. Yeah. So the TBD Trio is a very unique sound to the Fargo-Moorhead area. They draw inspiration from groups like Pentatonix, kind of inspired by like a barbershop quartet is like the closest thing I could say, or Pentatonix. Something.
Oh, cool. So if you went to the Pentatonix sold-out show at the Fargo Dome, come down. Maybe you'll catch a little bit of that wave again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, very cool. And I see that I was actually wondering this. You got some hay rides, right?
Yeah, we got a whole day of family activities planned. We have an area in the festival specifically dedicated for families. We have a family area at the festival that'll have a bunch of games.
Some arts and crafts.
Arts and crafts, that kind of thing. And then the folks at Crooked Lane are kind enough to offer out hay rides to the kids who want to partake.
Oh, that sounds like a fun day.
And also we should make sure to let people know to bring their instruments, because there will be jamming loud all across the grounds, and anything from bluegrass, old time, whatever steals your heart at the time, to just to get together and play with friends old and new.
I mean, that's almost the most important part of a good bluegrass festival, right? Is having some place for the kids to come bring their instruments and learn about bluegrass, learn how to play from some of the good players around. I mean, that's just the coolest thing.
Yeah, we have a beginning bluegrass workshop jam class. As we'll have an upright bass, a dobro, a guitar, fiddle, mandolin. We'll have all the instruments there, and kids who are just dipping their feet into the music for the first time can pick one up and give it a try.
All right, learn how to play the dobro. You can too.
Yeah.
Always wanted to, so that's cool. Yeah, hey, let's talk about Kohlrabi Soup, since we have three members of the band in here. We got an upright bass player, we got a guitarist, a fiddle player, and singer. Love the name. I don't even know. I feel dumb for saying this. I don't even know what Kohlrabi Soup is. Is that like Neffle soup? Is that a regional delicacy? What is that?
Well, listeners who are familiar with kohlrabi as a vegetable, or those who are not, kohlrabi is basically, the way I've heard it described best is it tastes like a cabbage and it's got the texture of an apple. A very Midwest vegetable. And this group originally started as a quartet a little over 3 years ago. Our first show was at a venue in Fargo, Front Street Tap Room, at one of the bluegrass jams. the band that we put together was the broth or the soup for the kohlrabi, as it was a little bit soupy, but super fun.
Soupy, but super fun. I like that. Love the name. Well, we got Steve on acoustic guitar and sounding great.
That's right.
And we've got Aaron on fiddle and vocals, and Joey on upright bass. Just a fantastic trio this morning, and you're going to hear from them here in just a moment. So, Mary, I'll defer to you here. So, since you have your son here in the studio, listeners can't see it, but I can see that you're beaming with pride when he's when he's playing, which is awesome, and it speaks to, you know, the power of music and music education, right?
That's what music is about in general. It's all about sharing and all about loving friends and family. All
right,
bringing people together.
Bringing people together.
Yep, and you're bringing people together in Colfax. One more time on the details of the Red River Roots Bluegrass and Folk Festival.
Yeah, it'll be September 13th, a one-day event in Colfax at Crooked Lane Farm. So it's about a 40-minute drive south of Fargo.
How can people get info on the event and tickets?
So we have both a website and a Facebook page. If you type in redriverroots-nd.com, as in northdakota.com.
Great time, great vibes. My guests have been members of the Roots band Kohlrabi Soup, Aaron Niehaus, Joey Pettit, and Steve Burkett. We also had Mary Niehaus and Adam Davis hanging out with us today. Folks, thank you for coming in here to Main Street. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you bet. How about taking us out with one more? And this is, you can set this one up because I heard you guys rehearsing this, and this is a really kind of a minor key, almost gypsy jazz-ish song. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a song that I wrote and we arranged together as a group. It's called The Revenuer, and it's inspired by the events in early downtown Chicago where there was a history of flooding. And basically what the city did is they built like a whole second layer on top of downtown Chicago because the storefronts were always getting flooded, and it created a network of tunnels underneath the streets. And Al Capone used those tunnels for transporting moonshine back in the Prohibition days. Papa was salty and sweaty, he came through the door. He worked real hard all day. The door was a pounding, a man outside with a black tie and a suitcase. Papa turned and walked away. Cornstalks whispered, shuffling footsteps out the back door. A sunset in the sky. The shack out back, it had no windows, no way to look in. No revenuers in his sight. In that bar. Place he called his lonesome hideaway. There were stumpy boots banging on the ceiling, wrangling Papa down. Only Papa knew what was going on that day. Chicago's like a jungle.
Got grounders and gangsters running round for fun. There were stomping boots banging in the tunnels, wrangling underground. Under the city streets, moonshine flows like blood. Got an Illinois farmstead, a darling and the kids. A 40-acre farm. We got horses, coon dogs, roosters, and chickens. But when the moon is foggy, there's a rumbling, gurgling somewhere in that bar. In that bar. Stomping boots banging on the ceiling, wrangling Papa down. Only Papa knew what was going on that day. Only Papa knew what was going on that day.
You just heard The Revenueer, a nice live performance from Kohlrabi Soup, who are headlining the first ever Red River Roots Bluegrass and Folk Fest on September the 11th in beautiful Colfax, North Dakota. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Buffalo's Fire, Native-founded, Native-led, covering local Native news. Buffalo's Fire and Prairie Public will be at the UTTC International Powwow, September 5th through 7th in Bismarck.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's esteemed news director, is with us for the weekly news chat. And Dave, you're getting close to 50 years of coverage here at Prairie Public, so I know you've literally seen it all. But these school shootings, like that occurred yesterday during morning mass at a Catholic school in Minneapolis, that left two children dead and scores injured. All right, usually I don't like long wind-ups to questions. I just like asking them right away, but if you'll allow me this little preamble.
Sure.
Thanks. Every time this happens, as we all know, you get thoughts and prayers, you get the backlash to thoughts and prayers, you hear amplified calls for more gun control, you hear the equally, if not louder, rejection of that, and then the usual guns don't kill people, people do, you hear calls for better mental health care and internet scrutiny for high-risk kids and adults, but let's face it, nothing really changes. You'd think after Sandy Hook there'd be a will to do something, you know, put heads together, collaborate, and figure out something. But these events now just seem to be met with, at first, sadness and shock, and then a shrug. Now, Northwest and Western Minnesota, Dave, they're in our coverage area. Are there any renewed efforts to address this, at least from a legislative standpoint?
So far, we haven't heard anything from the Minnesota legislature yet. However, the mayor of Minneapolis was on, and he said, hey, if the federal government doesn't do it or a state government doesn't do it, I think I have the power as the Minneapolis mayor to do something. He would not outline what that would be, but you could tell it was frustration in his voice when you heard him this morning.
That might be kind of hard to do something as a mayor to draft any sort of gun control.
That's true, and you probably have to take it to a council and have a look at that. And if there's some kind of ordinances, if you can do something about better background checks for sales of guns, maybe you can do that. But, you know, guns are going to get out, probably.
Nothing.
That's
really
the way
gets
it
done.
Seems to be at this point, yes.
Yeah, terrible story yesterday. Well, Dave, Senator John Hoeven said we have to have a big stick. And no, it's not a baseball metaphor, but he's talking about our country's nuclear deterrent. So you were up in Minot with the senator. Tell us about the Sentinel Project.
Well, the Sentinel Project has been on the drawing board for a couple of years now. What they want to do is step up our game when it comes to the missiles and step up our game when it comes to B-52 bombers. They would all be used for deterrence, not necessarily for an attack. But Minot's looking forward to it because, you know, Minot's the only base that has two-thirds of the nuclear triad, and they're looking forward to the upgrades and what that could mean economically for the region, because you're going to probably be bringing in construction workers. They're going to spend a lot of money in town. Then you take some time building the project, and then you have maybe more staff. Sometime this fall, there should be a map of where these new locations for the silos are going to be. So that's going to be one step. Now, another thing, Eric, I've got to say, there are two other bases, Malmstrom in Montana and F.E. Warren in Wyoming, and they're going to get the upgrades for the missiles. And Senator Hovind, Senator Cramer, and people in North Dakota saying, hey, let's not do it like the old way. You do Warren first, perhaps, and then Malmstrom, then Minot. Said, let's do it all together, because if you do it all together, you're going to save money on construction because of construction inflation. So that's why they're really pushing that the three be done concurrently. Whether or not that's going to happen will depend on the money flow. There is right now $5.1 billion in the fund to upgrade to Sentinel. And they're hoping that they'll get more as the project nears start here.
Well, nearing the start, I'm sure that officials in Minot are just excited for the economic boon that could come from this, right?
Absolutely. I
mean, you talk about how more housing, maybe on base, maybe off base, and obviously the local economy will be fueled by additional staff. So any idea of the timeline of when these silos, when this upgrade will begin and when it'll be done?
Well, I think we might have a better idea of the timeline when they release the maps of where the silos are going to be built, and that's going to be sometime probably mid to late fall to this year. And I'm thinking still probably a year to two out before they start construction. But there's an interesting thing, Eric, for people in Minot. The new high school in Minot is named Sentinel.
That should tell you something,
right?
That
should tell you a lot, yes.
Anticipation, right? That's a good thing, yeah. Well, you know, for those who are new to North Dakota, let's tap into your 50-year almost history of covering this state. Because back when I was here in the 90s and my first stint in North Dakota, there were nuclear missiles pretty much everywhere, or at least in a lot of chunks of land throughout the state. And you mentioned Malmstrom, so some of it was decommissioned and then moved to Malmstrom. So what kind of nuclear footprint is there in North Dakota now?
We still have a substantial nuclear footprint. It may not be as extensive as it was, because at one point Grand Forks Air Force Base had missiles too. Grand Forks does not have a missile mission now. Grand Forks is doing more with drones and more with planes. Minot keeps the nuclear missiles and the B-52s. The footprint has shrunk a little bit. And if I may make a little pitch here, Eric.
Sure, sure.
If you get a chance, you should go to Carrington sometime, anybody who's listening, and go to the missile silo, which is now called the Ronald Reagan Minuteman Missile Silo. You can actually go through it and take a look at it before it was decommissioned. It's really kind of fascinating to see the working conditions for missileers.
Well, as a Cold War kid myself, Dave, I've been meaning to go to that for quite some time. You've just given me some extra motivation for sure.
I've been there twice. It's really done very well, by the way.
Really, really cool. Yeah, it's a really neat thing to see in North Dakota. And it also, you know, just sort of brings the gravity of what all this is and what it means
right.
to the forefront. And it's a good place for contemplation and discovery.
That big stick analogy is there, because they said right off, we don't want to have to push the button and start something. But we believe that this is going to prevent our perceived enemies from launching any attack on the United States.
Well, that's good, because things are getting a little more tense, I'd say, in the world, right?
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of tension, data centers, they are known kind of as the backbone of artificial intelligence. They're becoming quite a thing in North Dakota. There's a big one in Ellendale, which we have covered.
Mm-hmm.
But our own Todd McDonald recently went to a town meeting in Harwood, just north of Fargo, regarding a proposed data center there. So set the scene for those who missed it.
You know, the data center in Ellendale has been embraced by the community, definitely. Brings more jobs, brings more economic development. Harwood is hoping for the same thing. And the governor of North Dakota is very much in favor of data centers because, you know, they can operate in the cold and they can operate within itself, if you catch my drift.
Right.
So Harwood is kind of embracing it, but people in the Fargo area are worried about what is this going to mean for electric prices. They're hoping that it's not going to go up, because at one point, There are data centers also in northwestern North Dakota, and data centers and their use were blamed for electricity going up in the Bismarck Mandan area, which now they have said that's not the case. But you do worry about that. Is there going to be enough power to go around? So that's one thing that I think everybody has to kind of realize, okay, let's take a look here. Is there going to be enough power to run both data centers and what we use at home in businesses too?
And company officials, correct me if I'm wrong, they at this town meeting, they try to assure residents that, no, your power is not going to go up. Did the residents believe that, or are they a little bit on the skeptical side?
Well, from what I understand from talking to Todd about what happened, the people who are Harwood natives who really want this, saying they're buying it, but people in Fargo, not necessarily as much, because, you know, they are very much a power grab. It takes an awful lot of electricity to power these data centers.
Well, and of course, data centers make the case, some people would say, in the fossil fuel industry, that we need more fossil fuels, we need more coal power.
That's correct. Basin Electric, for example, the Basin Electric Power Cooperative in Bismarck, is building a natural gas electric plant in northwest North Dakota to serve an increased load. Now, they say it's maybe some data centers might come along, but right now it's to serve the load in the Bakken for the oil companies and the natural gas processing plants. So there's a lot of demand for electricity still in North Dakota.
Well, we can definitely say that North Dakota is on the cusp of what's next, because AI is, whether we know it or not, it's going to be a big change in our lives if it hasn't already, right?
It is huge change.
All right, Dave, now you alluded to, and I alluded to, your experience, your decades of experience here at Prairie Public. Now, I've got to ask you, sir, I have never had my face plastered on a billboard before. You have. In fact, I see you and wave to you every day on Main Avenue in Fargo on the way home. So I got to ask, what's it like to have a billboard with your mug on it?
You won't believe the amount of comment I've gotten on it. And I'm sure they took that picture probably 25 years ago on that billboard.
And
it's kind of
nice.
I don't have as much gray hair on that one. But it's been kind of interesting. The minute they went up, for example, in the capital city, and I'd go to the capital and, oh, star of radio and billboards, yes. So I get a reaction.
You
like
get
that.
A little good-natured ribbing. It's good-natured from the ribbing. Lawmakers. That's great. Well, we've got the breakdown on this week's news with our own Dave Thompson, the voice and the face of Prairie Public. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it.
See you. The FM Kicks Band presents summer big band concerts showcasing the sound of jazz for 50 years. Big band music at Viking Ship Park in Moorhead on September 9th at 3 p.m. Details at fmkicksband.com. All right, that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge. If you're listening in the 3 o'clock hour, All Things Considered is coming up next. Craig Blumenschein is back in the driver's seat on Tuesday. Of course, we've got Labor Day coming up Monday. We'll have a specialty show for you here during this time slot for Main Street. In the meantime, I hope you have yourself a wonderful rest of your Thursday.